on the right, who had narrow brown eyes and a face pockmarked from adolescent acne.
"I agree with you, friend," he said in German. "I loathe overcooked bratwurst."
The Nazi cocked his head, impressed.
"You speak excellent German."
"I am German. I was raised there, but moved here when I was little. I'm from the north, in Osnabrück."
Marco knew of the city from his old friend Rolf.
"It's a lovely town. We used to take trips to Bremen on the weekend."
"I'm from Köln," the Nazi offered.
But Marco didn't know anything about Köln, so he got to the point.
"My mother sent me here. I'm hoping you can give me some information. One of her friends knows a Jew who got sent here. Where are they being sent from here?"
"Just give me some information to shut her up. You know how they nag."
The Nazi nodded.
"They're going to a labor camp in the north, out of the country."
"When?"
"Monday morning around 9.
Marco hid his alarm. It was sooner than he'd expected to hear.
"Do me one more favor. Is there a way I can talk to the guy? His name is Sandro Simone."
The Nazi snorted.
"No, it's not allowed. There's about 1,000 Jews in there, so I can't find him anyway. If you let me in, I can find him."
"You've got balls, friend."
The Nazi turned away and walked over to his friend. And just then, Marco heard a woman calling at the back of the crowd.
"Sandro! Sandro!"
Marco turned around and spotted her in the rain, waving a note in the air. He should have known she would come. She managed to look beautiful, even with wet hair clinging to her face.
"Elisabetta! Marco?"
Marco made his way to her, and Elisabetta came forward to meet him. He embraced her, moved by her tears.
"Is Sandro here?"
she asked, sniffling as he released her.
"Yes, with his father.
His mother is at my house."
"What can we do?"
Elisabetta wiped her eyes.
"Let's go home. We can talk about it." "No, I want to give him my note. Will you help me?"
"I can try, but even if I could get the guard to take it, they won't know which one is him."
"Yes, they will. He has basil in the buttonhole of his jacket. I put it there last night."
Marco's mouth went dry. He didn't know when Elisabetta and Sandro had started sleeping together, but even a fool could tell that she was deeply in love.
"Let me have the note, then." "Thank you."
Elisabetta handed him a crumpled piece of paper.
"It tells him I love him."
"I assumed that, cara," Marco said, masking his pain. Chapter 117. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco, his parents, Elisabetta and Gemma, gathered around the Terizzi's kitchen table. His mother served rolls with jam, and they were on their second pot of ersatz coffee. He and his father had changed from their wet clothes, and Marco's mother had lent a dark dress to Elisabetta and a flowered one to Gemma, who slumped at the table, her eyes puffy behind her rimless glasses. Her arm was bruised, and she rested it under an ice bag. Bar Giro Sport was closed, the only time since Aldo's funeral.
"Let's collect our thoughts,"
his father said, exhaling heavily.
"Yes."
Marco's mother put an arm around Gemma's sloping shoulders.
"We have to keep our hopes up. I've been praying all morning."
"Thank you, Maria."
Gemma sniffled, so forlorn in the cheery dress that she looked like a pile of broken flowers. She had told them how the hospital had saved Rosa and the other Jewish patients with the syndrome K ruse. In any other circumstances, it would have struck them as funny. His mother added,
"I called Emedio and begged him to see what he can do for Massimo and Sandro. He said he will talk to the powers that be."
Gemma wiped a tear from underneath her glasses.
"I can't bear to think of Massimo and Sandro in a labor camp. I hear horrible stories about the conditions there."
Marco's father patted Gemma's hand.
"We can't let that happen. We have to free them."
"Are you going to try?"
Gemma asked, hopeful.
"Really?"
"Of course. We have to think of a way."
His father glanced at Marco.
"Right, son?"
"Yes,"
Marco answered without hesitation. He felt a stab of anguish when he flashed on Sandro being loaded onto the truck and Massimo's little wave.
Here's the problem.
His father finished his coffee.
The Collegio Militare is too secure, too well protected to break Massimo and Sandro out. It would be disastrous.
Gemma deflated, her mouth turning down.
Come Monday morning, they're on trains to the north.
His father frowned in thought.
However, the trains have to stop once or twice before they leave the country. We could find out where they stop from partisans in the north. We could ambush the trains at one of the stations.
Marco shook his head. Papa, that won't work.
I know. Too many innocent lives would be lost, and we wouldn't know which train car held Massimo and Sandro.
It's too bad they're not going to a labor camp in Italy, like Fossoli. We'd have a chance there. His father blinked, puzzled.
What camp at Fossoli, son?
It's a transit camp used for temporary detention. The Nazis sent POWs there. My boss at Palazzo Venezia was involved in supervising its construction. It was built last year, only 6 kilometers from the Carpi train station. They were building a new section, the last I heard.
Gemma rallied. I know the town of Fossoli. It's in Carpi, a small town outside Modena. I grew up in Reggio, and my parents ran an acciaia and made balsamico.
That's the place.
Marco nodded. His father pursed his lips.
It doesn't matter. They're not being sent to Fossoli. They're going out of the country.
Elisabetta rose abruptly.
I have to go.
Gemma looked over, puzzled.
Where?
Maria frowned, worried.
Why?
Marco stood up.
Elisabetta, you're not going out there alone. It's not safe.
His father stood up next to him.
Neither of you are going anywhere without me.
You both can come.
Elisabetta set her jaw, grabbed her bag, and hurried to the stairwell.
But I'm in charge.
Chapter 118. Elisabetta, 16th October 1943. Elisabetta was shown to a tastefully decorated office with brocade curtains, damask-covered chairs, shelves lined with leather-bound books, and oil landscapes of Tuscany in heavy gilt frames. She had asked Marco and his father to wait across the street because she had a personal relationship with Baron von Weizsäcker from the restaurant. She knew that the Baron was fond of her, and she hoped to use that goodwill to help Sandro and his father. She had thought of a plan, and Marco and his father had agreed that it might work. This was the first step. Weizsäcker rose from behind an ornate desk, his blondish-gray hair perfectly in place. His hooded eyes had a pleasant, if puzzled, glint at her presence. And he was typically well-tailored in a dark suit with a gray silk tie. He had an aristocratic air that previously would have made Elisabetta conscious of her humbler origins. But the war had changed her. Social class mattered less to her than it used to. And she had learned that there was only one class that mattered in war, survivors.
Elisabetta, come in and sit down.
Weizsäcker smiled with his nice, even teeth, gesturing to the chair across from his desk.
Thank you.
Elisabetta took a seat, and Weizsäcker returned to the cushioned chair behind his desk.
I'm accustomed to seeing you across a delicious entree, not a desk.
I know. Elisabetta managed a smile.
Thank you for agreeing to see me.
Not at all.
What is it you wanted to discuss?
First, I want to apologize for the last time you were at the restaurant with Colonel Kepler. I'm sorry about my clumsiness.
Oh? Weizsäcker lifted a gray eyebrow. I don't think it was accidental.
Elisabetta hesitated, disarmed.
Baron, you're right. You and I have known each other for a long time. Nana always called you a gentleman. Colonel Kepler is not of your ilk. Discretion dictates that I keep my own counsel. Weisiger pursed his lips. Now, why did you wish to see me? Baron, I'm here asking for a favor. The Jews were rounded up from the ghetto today and brought to the Collegio Militare. One of them is my boyfriend, Sandro Simone, and the other is his father, Massimo. Weisiger's expression darkened, but he didn't interrupt her. Sandro is a brilliant mathematician, and his father is a respected tax attorney. Isn't there any way you can get the Simones out? No. Weisiger frowned, leaning back in his chair. You're mistaking my function. I am the German ambassador to the Holy See, a member of my government's foreign office. As a career diplomat, my aim is to smooth out differences, not to create them. But there must be something you can do. You're so well respected, so important. You must have some influence. Please help the Simones. I'm begging you. Elisabetta leaned forward, unable to hide her urgency, but Weisiger's expression remained matter of fact. I couldn't, even if I wanted to. It's simply outside the scope of my authority. But it's horrible, what happened today. It's wrong. It's criminal. You must know that, Baron. You can't agree with this. You can't do this to the Jews of Rome. I'm sure the Pope doesn't. Again, I have no power to order their release. Elisabetta swallowed hard, trying to maintain her composure. If she didn't succeed here, all was lost. Then I have a much more modest request. If you can't have the Simones released, can't you at least have them sent to a labor camp in Italy, instead of out of the country? There's a labor camp at Fossoli. It's in the town of Carpi, near Modena. Again, you're mistaken. Weisiger spread his palms. The camp at Fossoli is not a labor camp. It's a transit camp. A way station before deportation. But Italian Jews are being sent there, aren't they? Yes, but only temporarily. And I understand the camp is building a new section, too. I assume it uses prisoners to do manual labor, doesn't it? I have no idea. Weisiger cocked his head. How do you know all this? I asked around. I have to help Sandro and his father. Please, Baron, can't you get the Simones sent to Fossoli? They can help build the new section. They're both strong and able. What difference does it make to you, whether they go to Fossoli or out of the country? If the Simones go to Fossoli, it gives me more time to petition for their release. I intend to ask everyone I can. There are so many important people among our clientele, like you. I'm going to ask every one of them to help. I have a chance if Sandro and his father are sent to Fossoli, but not if they're deported. Elisabetta paused. And I have friends in Carpi, our balsamic producers. You love the balsamico we serve? Nonna used only the best acettaia there. Maybe I could visit Sandro, if he was sent to Fossoli. You're putting me in a terrible position. I know, but I can't help it. Elisabetta felt tears in her eyes. I love Sandro, and he loves me. Weisiger frowned, but had no reply. Baron, I'm appealing to you, as a gentleman. We have a relationship, don't we? One of mutual respect. If you deny me this request, how can you ever look me in the eye again? Weisiger lifted an eyebrow, mildly amused. Are you holding Casa Servano as hostage?
Yes, Elisabetta shot back, unsmiling. She sensed a tiny shift in the balance of power between them. She found herself standing instead of begging. If you deny me, you can't eat at my restaurant ever again.
Chapter 119. Beppe, 16th of October, 1943. Beppe climbed the stairs to their apartment with Marco and Elisabetta behind him. But when he reached the kitchen, what he found left him breathless with rage. The bear-like Stefano Prettiani from Ovra held Gemma, pressing a knife against her throat. Her eyes had gone round with terror behind her glasses. Carmine Vecchio stood behind Maria, his hand clamped on her shoulder. His wife sat frozen in a chair, her face a mask of mute horror. Carmine sneered.
Welcome home, Beppe.
Beppe suppressed the fury in his chest. He knew instinctively he had to proceed with caution. Let the women go. Your fight is with me. Marco added, and me. Carmine's dark eyes glittered with malice.
I finally got you where I want you, Beppe. I'm turning you and your family in. You're hiding a Jewess. She gets what she deserves.
No! Beppe shouted. But Stefano yanked his knife across Gemma's throat, slicing it open. Gemma's eyes flared in agony. Blood spurted from the gruesome gash. She emitted a hideous gurgling sound. Beppe roared, launching himself at Carmine and Stefano. Marco appeared at his side, running at the men. Stefano released Gemma, who collapsed to the floor, bleeding. Maria and Elisabetta rushed to her side, screaming in horror. Beppe punched Stefano in the face. Stefano reeled backward, his nose exploding in blood. He dropped his knife. Marco headbutted Carmine, who crumpled, stunned. Marco slugged him, but Beppe spotted Carmine slip his hand in his pocket. Beppe knew it was a gun, so he charged Carmine. The gun went off with a deafening report. Beppe grabbed Carmine by the ears and banged his head against the wall, knocking him senseless. Carmine got off another shot as he slid down. Beppe snatched Stefano's knife from the floor and plunged it deep into Carmine's chest. Carmine's eyes popped. Meanwhile, Marco punched Stefano, who punched him back harder. Marco staggered, reeling. Stefano turned to the stairwell to run away. Beppe lunged after Stefano, grabbed the big man, yanked him off balance, then threw him into the wall headfirst. The impact stunned Stefano. Marco punched Stefano again, knocking the big man backward. Stefano's arms flailed. He fell, groaning. Blood poured from his broken nose. Beppe picked up a chair, stalked to Stefano, and beat him with the chair until his skull showed. Stefano lay motionless, and Beppe dropped the chair with a clatter.
Beppe! Maria screamed behind him. You're bleeding. You've been shot.
I'm okay, Beppe told her. But warm blood bubbled in his throat. He remembered the coppery taste from the Great War.
Papa, no!
Marco shouted, his eyes wide.
Don't worry.
Beppe looked down to see crimson bursts on his chest, blooming like grotesque flowers. He didn't feel anything. He knew that he was losing blood fast.
Beppe!
Maria rushed to his side. Beppe dropped to his knees. He was going into shock. He had seen enough to know. Men had died from such wounds at Caporetto.
Beppe, don't leave!
Maria sobbed. Beppe tried to reassure her, but he fell to the side. Maria knelt beside him and turned him onto his back. Her tears dropped onto his face.
I love you, my wife,
Beppe told her, his words drowned in blood.
Papa!
Marco appeared on his other side, anguished.
No!
Beppe reached for Marco's arm.
Take care of your mother.
Beppe closed his eyes, feeling his soul edge away from them, seeking the hands of God. He took comfort in the faith that he would see Aldo soon, and he and Aldo would both perish on the side of justice. He let go of his mortal life, and all of the years he had spent walking the cobblestones of Rome and the rocky soil of Abruzzo, ending the sum total of the days granted him by God, each one spent in an Italy he had loved and bled for, a country of passion and emotion as gloriously turbulent as the human heart. His soul ascended to a higher and better life, one that never ended. Chapter 120. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Four people lay dead in the Terrizzi kitchen, and the gruesome scene spurred Marco into action despite his grief. He called Emedio and told him the terrible news, and Emedio came and comforted their mother. Then he called Arnaldo, his father's old war buddy, who arrived with a car, wrapped the corpses of Carmine and Stefano in blankets, and took them from the apartment to dump them in the Tiber on the outskirts of the city. It was Marco's plan, which ironically exploited the lack of carabinieri and the Nazis' ruthless preoccupation with rounding up the Jews. After that, Marco called Nino Venuti, a local undertaker who agreed to a false story of his father's death. The public would be told that Beppe Terrizzi, the former professional cyclist and popular proprietor of Bar Giro Sport, had died suddenly of a heart attack at his home. His wake would be held on Monday, and his body would lie in an open casket, dressed in a suit that would hide his wounds. His funeral mass and burial would be held the next morning, and nobody would suspect the truth. Marco would have preferred a Jewish undertaker for Gemma, but the Nazis had taken them all. He had to settle for Nino, who arrived at the house with two assistants, older men like him, balding and dressed in black suits. My God. Nino scanned the kitchen, appalled. Marco kept his gaze averted, not to succumb to emotion. What about the Dottoressa Simone? I told you she was Jewish. You said on the phone you would do right by her. We will bury her tomorrow morning, timely under Jewish law. I have a simple pine casket and have arranged for a plot near the Jewish section in Verano. It would be too dangerous to bury her in the Jewish section. I falsified her death certificate. It's the best we can do in the circumstances. His mother looked up from the table, tearful. Thank you, Nino. Gemma was a very dear friend of our family. My deepest condolences, Maria. Nino gestured to Gemma. Now, if I may, my assistants and I will take Dottoressa Simone first. We have said our final goodbyes to her. His mother nodded, but she and Elisabetta wept again as Nino and his assistant went to Gemma with a black velvet sack trimmed with gold braid. They laid it flat on the floor, unzipped it, and carefully placed her body inside. They zipped up the velvet bag, fetched a canvas stretcher, placed Gemma's body on it, then carried it downstairs. Marco cleared his throat. I should say goodbye to Papa now, before they take him. His mother looked over, sniffling. You don't have to now. They'll give us time before the viewing. Right. Emedio nodded, his arm around her, and Marco realized he hadn't had a chance to tell them about their plan. Mum, I'm sorry, but I can't stay for the viewing, and I might not be back for the funeral. What? His mother asked, shocked. What do you mean? You have to be there. It's your father's funeral. I can't stay. We think that Elisabetta persuaded Baron von Weizsäcker to send Sandro and Massimo to Fossoli instead of out of the country. That means I have to be in place before their train arrives. I have to leave today. Oh, no. His mother nodded, crestfallen. Her lower lip trembled, and Emedio hugged her closer. She nodded in resignation. I suppose your father would understand. Yes, he would. He and I talked about it on the way home before... Marco couldn't finish the sentence. And Gemma would, too. You honor her memory trying to help Massimo and Sandro. His mother frowned, wiping her eyes.
But you aren't going to Fossoli alone, are you? Can't Arnaldo go with you?
No, he has to deal with Carmine and Stefano.
I'm going with him,
Elisabetta interjected, and they all turned to her. Marco shook his head.
Elisabetta, you can't. It's dangerous.
Then it will be dangerous for us both. Marco looked at her a long moment, then turned to the sound of Nino and his assistants climbing up the stairs. The undertakers entered the kitchen with the stretcher and another black velvet bag. His mother began to cry softly, and they laid the velvet bag on the ground beside Marco's father. They were about to move him when Marco stepped forward.
Let me take care of him,
Marco heard himself say. Nino looked over, sympathetic.
No, Marco, we can. I want to.
Marco crossed to his father, knelt down beside him, and placed his hands underneath his father's big shoulder, then shifted it onto the velvet bag. Then he did the same thing with the other shoulder, moving him bit by bit. His father was heavy, but Marco focused his effort. He kept shifting his father over and sliding the velvet cover of the bag over him. He covered both sides of his father's body, then zipped the bag partway up from the bottom. He heard his mother and Elisabetta weeping, and Amedeo praying, but his heart focused on this final task. His tears fell onto the velvet, though he hadn't known he was crying. He zippered the bag until it reached his father's chin. Marco let his gaze take in his father's face one last time. Beppe Terrizzi was a strong man with strong features, his skin weathered by sun and marked by age, still with the scar on his lip from where the wolf had bitten him as a boy. Looking at that scar, Marco realized that his father had been born with a heart that fought and loved with equal ferocity. So it was perhaps inevitable that he and his father would fight each other at times, but also would always love each other, just as strongly. Marco knew that of the three Terrizzi sons, he himself was the most like his father. And that was why his father had expected the most from him. For his father always expected the most from himself. He kissed his father on the forehead, feeling the warmth ebbing from his father's skin.
I love you, Papa,
he whispered through his tears. And he knew his father heard him.
Chapter 121 Rosa 16th of October, 1943 Rosa sniffled, her tears finally subsiding. Maria had come to the hospital to tell her that her mother was dead, along with Beppe, and that her father and Sandro had been rounded up. The news had overwhelmed Rosa, engulfing her in sorrow and grief. Maria had comforted her and even cried with her, which helped her through the initial shock. The word of her mother's murder spread to Dr. Cristabello, Sister Anna Domenica, and her mother's former colleagues, who had come by to pay their respects. Even now, nuns looked over in sympathy as they swept through the ward, their black habits stark against the whiteness. Rosa wiped her eyes, trying to fathom the loss. She hadn't even gotten to say goodbye to her mother. But everyone had told her the amazing story about the syndrome K ruse, and her mother disguised in Sister Anna Domenica's habit of all things. Her mother had risked her own life to save Rosa's, and Rosa loved her so much. She wished David were here, but he was in harm's way too. Fear for him made her want to cry all over again.
I'm so sorry.
Maria held her hand, her eyes swollen and bloodshot. She had on a black dress, but no jewelry. And Rosa remembered the gold crucifix she had contributed to satisfy the Nazi demand for gold, which had been a cruel lie.
What an awful day.
Rosa pressed Maria's handkerchief to her eyes.
And Papa, and Sandro, too.
I didn't mean to burden you when you were ill. but I felt you should know as soon as I could tell you. I appreciate that. Thank you. Rosa blew her nose, her eyes stinging. Her chest felt hollow and empty, her mouth dry. She still had a fever, but her own illness was beside the point now. Maria squeezed her hand.
It is so hard to imagine your mother gone. And Beppe, it's impossible. I'm so sorry about Beppe.
Rosa had never felt closer to Maria. The two families had always been friends, but now they were joined forever, having a tragedy in common. A wave of despair washed over Rosa, knowing that there would be no justice for her mother's murder or for Beppe's. War welcomed and concealed the most heinous of crimes.
Beppe tried to save her. I know he died the way he wished to, as a fighter.
Rosa patted her hand.
He was a remarkable man, an oak. And you know my father loved him.
Maria nodded, managing a smile.
Marco was devastated. It's hard on him, after Aldo. I'm sure.
Rosa remembered Aldo with a pang.
I'm grateful to Marco for trying to save Sandro and my father.
She paused, her head fogged with grief.
But who's helping Marco, if not Beppe?
Elisabetta.
That's all.
Rosa couldn't hide her despair. There had to be a way she could help. She started to rise, but eased back, weak and dizzy.
Maybe I can talk to the doctor. No, you need to get well.
Maria patted her hand.
By the time you're ready to leave the hospital, Emedio will have false documentation for you and a place to live in the Vatican.
How can I go? With Papa and Sandro in such jeopardy.
You must go, for them.
Maria leaned forward, her dark eyes flashing.
Your father and Sandro love you, and it will ease their burden to know that you're safe.
How will they know where I am?
Marco will get to them, and he will find a way to tell them. Think of your mother, Rosa. I know, as a mother, that she would want you to live the life that God gave you. Your survival will be her triumph.
Maria tilted her chin up in teary defiance.
Live in honor of her memory.
Rosa listened, hushed. She could almost hear her mother saying those same words.
Rosa. I know we're not the same religion, but we both believe in a just and loving God. I believe that he brought us all together so we can be family for each other now.
Maria looked at her, her love plain in her anguished eyes.
And think of your father, too. I have shared glasses of wine with him at the bar. What is his toast most of the time?
Rosa knew the answer.
L'chaim.
Maria nodded.
To life.
Tears filled Rosa's eyes. They felt true, and she let them flow. Chapter 122. Elisabetta. 16th October, 1943. Elisabetta stood next to Marco at the train station, waiting for the train to Carpi. She felt agonized by the horrific events of the day, and he had to feel worse. Neither of them spoke, and she had never seen him so somber. He looked around, dry-eyed, but his dark gaze didn't settle anywhere, as if it couldn't rest, even for a moment. He usually stood tall, but his broad shoulders sloped as if he had caved in on himself. Men and women around them on the platform talked, smoked, and read books and newspapers.
Elisabetta scanned the headlines, but she saw no reports of the rastrellamento. The Vatican still hadn't made any statement, and she was beginning to fear that they wouldn't. Elisabetta wondered if she and Marco had a realistic chance of saving Sandro and his father. Marco had a plan, but he hadn't shared it with her yet, and she hadn't pushed the matter, given his grief. Evidently, he had been a partisan, so presumably he had experience with fighting, but she didn't. Balilla training for boys was shooting long guns, but for girls, it was exercising with hula hoops. She checked the clock, concerned that the train hadn't yet boarded. She consulted the train schedule, which was printed in trifold and posted in front of them, in a case with a glass front.
Marco, look at this. Shouldn't the train be leaving already? It's 10 minutes past time. Do you think something's the matter?
Marco didn't even look at the schedule. I don't know. Want me to ask someone?
No, it's okay.
Elisabetta noticed he didn't read the train schedule. She flashed on his poor handwriting, filled with misspellings.
Here, we're about to board.
Marco pointed as travelers surged toward the train, and he and Elisabetta joined them. He helped her up the steps, then climbed in behind her. The train car was hot, dirty, and smoky inside. They found two seats and sat down. The train lurched off, leaving the station, and she looked out the window, which was filthy. The sky darkened as the afternoon wore on, and they wouldn't arrive in Carpi until nighttime. Marco shifted in his seat.
You should take a nap. We could be up all night.
I'm not tired.
Yes, you are.
How do you know?
I know what you look like when you're tired. Your eyes narrow. You squint.
Elisabetta wondered if he was right. She looked over, but Marco was scanning the other passengers, who kept up their chatter, smoking and reading. The train gathered momentum in a noisy, clacking rhythm, and they left Rome behind.
Elisabetta, close your eyes. I'll wake you when we get there.
Elisabetta couldn't sleep, and she knew Marco wouldn't either.
I'm sorry about your father.
Thank you.
We can talk about it, if you want to. I know how much you admired him. He was a great man.
Marco looked down at her.
Your father was great, too. I know that now.
Elisabetta didn't understand.
What do you mean?
You remember that night, when we were going to dinner? We ran into the ginger-haired man who yelled at you, who said your father's hands were broken by fascists.
Yes?
Elisabetta remembered, intrigued. It was the night she had given Marco his ring back.
He was telling the truth. My father told me the story.
Really?
Elisabetta asked in disbelief. She shifted up in the seat.
What happened?
Your father painted over a fascist slogan on a wall in Trastevere. That's why they broke his hands. My father warned him, and he went out of town, but came back too soon.
Marco lowered his voice.
You know the OVRA officers that killed my father and Gemma? They were the ones who did it.
Oh, my.
Elisabetta shuddered.
I had no idea of any of this.
Your father didn't want you to know. That's what the man said. He lied to protect you.
I never suspected he lied. I believed him.
Elisabetta's chest wrenched with regret.
I was so wrong.
No, you should have believed him. You loved him.
but I didn't appreciate him. I didn't know him as well as I thought I did. I'm proud of him, but I'm finding this out too late.
It's not too late. You can have a feeling of pride in him the rest of your life. It's good that you found out, even now.
Elisabetta felt a pang, looking at the countryside whizzing past the window. Marco cleared his throat hoarsely.
That's how I feel about my father. I will always be proud of him.
Tears came to Elisabetta's eyes, but she held them back. She felt profoundly sad for her father, for Marco, for his father, and for Gemma. For Sandro and Massimo, for Nonna, for the ghetto Jews, for Rome.
And I do have a plan. I'll give you the details when we get there. You want Sandro, so I'll get him for you.
Marco kept his eyes front.
You love him, right?
Yes.
I love him too. I would have chosen him too.
Marco paused.
But it doesn't mean I don't love you.
Elisabetta looked up at him. Marco managed a shaky smile.
Now go to sleep, cara.
Chapter 123. Sandro. 16th of October, 1943. Sandro and his father had been in the courtyard all day. The rain had stopped, but the sky stayed cloudy, darkening. The family sat in groups, hungry, thirsty, and frightened. Sandro had been watching them all day, and he had finally thought of a plan.
Papa, stand up.
Why?
I have an idea.
Sandro extended him a hand and lifted him to his feet.
What is it?
Look, the Nazis are letting anyone go who's not Jewish.
Sandro pointed to the front of the courtyard, where the Nazi officers had their security desk. Behind them was a short line of Gentiles and Mischlinge, the German term for half-Jewish and half-Gentile, being readied for release.
We can't convince them we're Gentile. I was a board member. My name must be on every record they have.
I know, but hear me. Sandro leaned close to his father. I've been watching all day, seeing our friends and neighbors. I kept noticing the families who are here, but then I realized I was making a mistake. I should have been noticing the families who aren't here.
What do you mean?
His father looked up, intrigued.
You know who I haven't seen? Matteo and Giovanni Rotoli. They aren't here.
From across the street?
Yes.
His father shrugged.
They must not have been home when the Nazis came.
Exactly.
Sandro felt his heart beat faster.
Matteo and Giovanni aren't here, so we can assume their identity. Remember, Matteo isn't Jewish. Only his wife Livia is. That makes Giovanni, his son, half-Jewish.
If the Nazis look up Matteo and Giovanni Rotoli on any list, they will appear as Mischlinge.
We can pass as them. We know everything about them.
You're right.
His father smiled, straightening.
We should try.
Follow my lead.
Sandro made his way through the crowd, with his father behind him. They reached the front of the courtyard where a Nazi officer stood at a lectern.
What do you want?
The Nazi frowned under the bill of his cap. Sandro willed himself to stay calm.
Sir, I'm Giovanni Rotoli, and this is my father Matteo. I'm Mischlinge, and my father is Gentile, a Roman Catholic. We live on Piazza Costaguti and were taken by accident.
Why didn't you say so before?
We were in a classroom. Please, we don't belong here.
Show me your identification cards.
We had to leave without them in a hurry.
Sandro held his breath as the Nazi officer began riffling through papers on his lectern. Behind him, other Nazis were lining up the Gentiles for release. The difference between deportation or salvation was centimeters.
Ah, so, Rotoli.
The Nazi pointed at the Rotoli surname on the papers, then glanced up.
Fine, get in the line, hurry, go.
Sandro masked the relief that flooded his heart. He turned to take his father's arm, and together they walked around another Nazi, guarding the line for release.
Get in line,
the Nazi guard said, then looked back at Sandro.
Hey, you, what's in your buttonhole?
Sandro looked down at his jacket. In his buttonhole was the basil from Elisabetta's garden, drooping now. She had given it to him last night.
It's just some basil.
Where did you get it?
My girlfriend,
Sandro answered, puzzled.
Ha! She gave me a note for you. You're Sandro Simone?
Sandro froze at the sound of his real name. His father looked over in fear. The Nazi at the lectern whipped his head around.
Simone, you filthy Jew. You said your name was Rotoli.
He yanked Sandro out of line, then cocked his arm to punch him. Sandro raised his hand to protect himself, but the first blow was already landing. Chapter 124. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco and Elisabetta disembarked at Carpi and found themselves at a small deserted train station that was more like a shed, open on three sides. The only light came from a bare bulb in the ceiling, and the air carried the smell of horse manure and an oddly acidic odor, perhaps from balsamico. He took his flashlight and compass from his backpack. Elisabetta looked around.
This is really the middle of nowhere.
There's only vineyards, like Gemma said.
Marco felt a pang of grief, but suppressed the emotion. He was on a mission, and Gemma would have wanted him to succeed.
So which way do we go?
Hold on.
Marco consulted his compass, then started walking.
This way. The transit camp at Fossoli is due northeast on the other side of Carpi.
Elisabetta fell into step beside him, and Marco shone the flashlight ahead of them. They walked down a dirt road, and there was nothing on either side, no homes or vineyards. About 2 kilometers ahead, he could see Carpi, a small cluster of lights and shadowy tile rooftops. Elisabetta looked over.
So what now?
I'd like to get as close to the transit camp as possible, to see how it works and get the lay of the land.
How long will it take to get there?
Probably an hour, maybe less.
They walked along, and in time crossed an intersection and a directional sign with arrows aiming different ways.
A sign, Elisabetta pointed.
I see.
It says Fossoli is straight ahead.
That's the way we're going.
Marco kept walking, breathing in the country air, which reminded him of Abruzzo, where his parents were from. His family had gone there to visit his grandparents from time to time. His father always talked about how he and his mother had fallen in love there and moved to Rome together, as if life were a grand adventure.
Marco, why didn't you tell me you can't read?
His mouth went dry. His face warmed.
It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Marco didn't know what to say.
Of course it was something to be ashamed of.
He walked straight ahead, so she couldn't see his expression.
Marco?
I can read.
I don't think you can.
Elisabetta's tone was sympathetic, not accusatory, which only made him feel worse.
Well, I can.
Then what did that sign say?
I don't need it. I rely on my compass. I have an excellent sense of direction.
Just tell me what it said.
It said we're going the right way.
You know that's not the point. It had the names of towns nearby and the distances.
Look, I admit, I don't read as well as you or Sandro. You read books and he's a genius. I'm smart, just not as smart as you guys.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
Marco wanted to believe she was right, but she wasn't.
That damn train schedule had given him away.
Marco, come on, you're very smart. I know you. I see what you do. Look at what you did today.
Today my father died.
Elisabetta touched his arm.
Even so, you figured out a story for Nino the Undertaker and a plan for Arnaldo. You spoke good enough German to fool that Nazi. You even got him to agree to give Sandro my note.
He did it because you're beautiful. Even Nazis like beautiful girls.
Marco shook his head.
And I doubt he gave it to Sandro anyway.
My point is that you're very intelligent.
Then what's the matter?
Marco blurted out, since it was a question he had asked himself over and over.
Why is reading harder for me?
Tell me what happens when you read. Marco sighed, pained. I don't know. What do you see on the page?
Everything looks mixed up.
Do you think it's your eyes? Do you need glasses?
No, I see fine.
Marco had already eliminated these possibilities. What happens when you write?
I don't know what to write. I don't know what to make anything look like.
I bet I can help you.
I bet you can't.
Marco walked faster.
Let me tell you the plan. That's what matters now.
Marco and Elisabetta reached Fossoli, found a vineyard, and lay on their stomachs between rows of grapevines, behind a thick underbrush. The transit camp was across from them, far enough to avoid their being seen. Its lights illuminated the night sky, unnaturally bright in the countryside. They had an unobstructed view, since the grapes and the vineyards in between had been harvested, the earth tilled in rows. Marco scanned the transit camp through the binoculars, reconnoitering. The camp was a long rectangle, set lengthwise on Via dei Grilli, running east to west and surrounded by three layers of post and barbed wire fencing. There were no guard turrets or watchtowers. The prisoners' barracks were long brick houses with small square windows, situated in rows on the east side of the camp and set perpendicular to the road. There were 10 barracks in a row and 8 rows of barracks, which flanked an aisle that ran down the middle of the camp, running parallel to Via dei Grilli. He shifted his binoculars to focus on the west side of the transit camp, where there were smaller structures, evidently offices and barracks for Nazi guards. Behind the transit camp on the southwest side, situated along Via de Messina, was a construction site, apparently where the Nazis were building the extension. Ditches had been dug for foundations, framed with wood. Bricks, wood, and building materials sat piled next to the frames and shovels, picks, spades, and other tools. Marco returned his attention to the transit camp proper. It was late, and no prisoners were about, so they must have been inside the barracks. Nazis guarded the perimeter, stationed at every 8th post. Some looked around, others smoked. One left by the south gate disappeared into the darkness and reappeared after a few moments buckling his belt, so presumably he had gone to urinate.
What do you see? Elisabetta whispered. The layout and other details. It's what I expected. Can I look?
Yes. Marco handed her the binoculars, and Elisabetta held it up to her eyes.
It's such a big camp.
Not very.
There's a lot of guards.
Not too many.
Are you sure we can do this?
Elisabetta lowered the binoculars, revealing a grimace.
Yes, Marco answered, though he wasn't.
Let me go it alone. It's too dangerous, I told you.
No, I want to do it. You need me for the plan now.
Still, I can think of another plan. Are you sure?
Yes.
Elisabetta raised the binoculars. Later, they walked along by moonlight, crossing vineyards and horse pastures. They came upon a large accettaia, with a small stone farmhouse, a barn, a chicken coop, and 2 outbuildings. They sneaked through rows of vines to the outbuildings, and Marco turned on his flashlight and shone it inside. The first outbuilding contained balsamico barrels, reeking of fermenting vinegar, and the other held stacked burlap bags. They chose the latter and went inside. The air smelt musty, and cobwebs draped from the low rafters. Marco cast the flashlight on the burlap bags.
We can sleep here. We'll be gone by dawn.
Good. Elisabetta eased into the earthen floor, leaning back against the bags.
I'm so tired. I could sleep sitting up.
I'll wake you up when it's time. I always know. Marco sat beside her, turning off the flashlight and plunging them into darkness. His eyes adjusted to his surroundings. Moonlight streamed through the small window. Elisabetta didn't respond. Marco looked over to find her already asleep. He exhaled, then let himself feel his own fear and anguish. Their mission was dangerous, with slim odds of success. He would lay down his life for Sandro and Massimo. But he would never forgive himself if anything happened to Elisabetta. He considered sneaking out while she slept and executing the plan alone. But he did need her, and she would have been furious with him. He leaned back on the burlap bags, closed his eyes, and rehearsed his plan in his mind. Tomorrow was the first step, and the more he thought about tomorrow, the less he thought about his father's death and Gemma's.
Chapter 125. Elisabetta. 17th October 1943. Elisabetta walked along Via Re Messina, swinging a bottle of wine. Bees buzzed in the vineyards, and the air smelled of fermenting balsamico and freshly cultivated earth. It was a sunny Sunday afternoon, perfect for a young girl to visit her grandparents, which was her false story. This was the next step of their plan, and its success depended solely on her. She had freshened her dress and combed her hair into place, as she needed to look her best. Marco was watching her through his binoculars from the ravine. She tensed at the sight of armed Nazis with dogs ahead at the transit camp. A group of them were guarding the prisoners laboring on the construction site at the back of the camp. Dump trucks with muddy tires were parked on the site, and lumber and tools had been stacked here and there. She reached the site, and the dogs began barking at her. Nazi guards and prisoners watched her pass by. The prisoners returned to their toil, but the Nazis smiled or winked at her. One Nazi blew her a kiss, which revolted her, but she waved back. She kept walking, reminding herself that she had an important role to play. She felt newly stronger, having learned the truth about how her father's hands had been broken. Now she was proud of him rather than ashamed. He had sacrificed to resist the fascists. She felt as if she were truly his daughter, doing her part to defy the Nazis. She reached the end of the construction site, walked along the side of the transit camp, and turned right on Via dei Grilli, heading for the main entrance. Inside, Nazis going in and out of the offices stopped to watch her walk by, smiling and waving. She smiled and waved back. The gates were open to construction traffic, and a group of Nazis surged forward to meet her, greeting her in German and broken Italian. She smiled, waved, and made eye contact with as many Nazis as possible, for her goal was to be memorable. She was never good at flirting, but she didn't have to be, for they seemed hungry for female attention. Suddenly, one of the dogs lunged at her, baring its teeth. Elisabetta jumped back, startled. "Oh, I'm very sorry, miss," the Nazi said in poor Italian. He reprimanded the dog, which quieted. "He's really very friendly. Would you like to pet him?" "No, thanks." Elisabetta made a funny face, and the Nazis laughed, evidently charmed. "Do you live nearby, miss?" "No, my grandparents do. I'm visiting." Elisabetta felt satisfied that she had made enough of an impression. "Well, I'd better go now. Goodbye. Will you come again sometime?" "I'll try," Elisabetta answered, knowing she would be back sooner than they expected.
Chapter 126. Marco, 17th of October, 1943. It was almost midnight. Darkness concealed Marco and Elisabetta, who were lying in the ravine side by side on their stomachs. Marco held the binoculars to his eyes, watching the transit camp. The prisoners were in their barracks. The construction site was quiet. The Nazis guarded their posts along the perimeter fence.
"What's going on?" Elisabetta asked, looking over.
"Nothing." Marco watched the Nazis, who examined their fingernails, brushed dirt from their coats, or smoked one cigarette after another. They stand there looking at the same vineyards night after night. That will help us when the time comes. They're bored to death. That's why they were so interested in me today. Marco lowered the binoculars. That's not why. You're a beautiful girl, carrying wine. It's what men dream of. Men like wine that much? No, men like women who like wine that much. Marco returned the binoculars to his eyes. Still, you did well. You were brave. Thank you. The next step will be harder. And there's always the possibility that Baron von Weizsäcker didn't get Sandro and his father sent here. If the Baron failed us, we're in trouble.
I think he did it.
Why?
I make the best pasta in Rome.
Marco smiled, falling in love with Elisabetta all over again. His heart ached for her, and he worried these feelings would never leave him. He stole a glance at her in the moonlight, but her eyes were on the camp. Chapter 127. Marco, 18th of October, 1943. The next day, Marco and Elisabetta were lying in the ravine, having camouflaged themselves with underbrush. It was already late afternoon, and they were still waiting for Sandro and his father to appear. If the train had left Rome this morning, then Sandro and his father should have already arrived, assuming that they had been on the train. Marco tried not to be discouraged. Elisabetta had fallen silent. He focused the binoculars on Via Messina, the road from Carpi Station. There was no sign of anyone. So far, the only traffic on that road or Via dei Grilli had been a mule cart, a farmer on horseback, and an old truck from an acciaia. He shifted left to the transit camp. It looked like business as usual, with Nazis on post at the perimeter. A group of Nazis guarded the construction site where the prisoners labored. No preparations were being made to receive new prisoners, which worried him. Marco watched and waited, then finally noticed something coming down Via Messina toward the transit camp. In the next moment, he realized that it was a few Kubelwagens, a Nazi escort. They must have come from Modena or elsewhere. Perhaps that accounted for the delay. His heart began to pound. The vehicles drew closer. He could see that behind them walked a bedraggled procession of men, women, and children. They're coming. Marco kept the binoculars to his eyes. Do you see Sandro? Elisabetta asked, excited. Not yet. Marco watched the shifting view of families trudging down the road. They clung to each other, downcast. He searched every face, hoping it was Sandro's or his father's. The heads bobbed and moved, a shifting mass of men, women, and children. He spotted Sandro, walking with his arm around Massimo, who was limping slightly. I see him.
Thank God. Can I look?
Not yet. I don't want to lose sight of him. Marco watched as the Kubelwagens and the line of families turned the corner toward the entrance to the transit camp. The Nazis opened the gates and allowed the Kubelwagens to enter. Other Nazis hustled to the line and hurried the families inside with guns and barking dogs. Marco watched as the families filed in. In time, Sandro and his father entered the transit camp and were hustled inside. The Nazis forced in the remaining families, then closed the gates. The families massed in front of the barracks, instinctively forming a group.